I'd like to begin with a story this morning. A couple of weeks ago, I was driving down Flat Avenue along where the Catholic parish St. Maria Goretti is located. And there was a little girl standing with a large cardboard box containing a number of kittens. And there was a sign which read, "Catholic kittens free to a good home." I chuckled and thought, what a clever marketing ploy, and drove on. And last week I was driving up Seminole Avenue and got to Nakoma Road and noticed that same little girl sitting in front of Westminster Presbyterian Church. This time the sign said, "Presbyterian kittens free to a good home." I smiled again and drove on. And then yesterday I pulled up here in front of Prairie, and there in the corner of Winona and Crawford, sitting on the curb, I spotted that same little girl with the same box of kittens. The sign now read, "Unitarian Universalist kittens free to a good home." I decided that I just had to get to know this little girl. So I asked her, "Excuse me, didn't I see you a couple of weeks ago in front of St. Maria Goretti Catholic Church selling Catholic kittens?" And she said, "Yes, you did." And then I asked, "And last week, weren't you sitting there by Westminster Presbyterian Church?" And she said, "Yes, that was me too." "Well," I asked, "what makes them Unitarian Universalist kittens now?" And she said with a spark in her voice and a twinkle in her eye, "Because this week their eyes are wide open." And we should keep our eyes wide open today, because there are troubling movements that should be of concern to us. Here's the cause of that concern. Last week, the governor of Louisiana signed a law into legislation that will require all public schools, kindergarten up through 12th grade, including state-funded universities, to display a poster-sized version of the Ten Commandments, beginning next year. And last month, the state of Oklahoma, their chief education officer, announced in a memorandum, quote, "All Oklahoma schools are required to incorporate the Bible and Ten Commandments in their curriculum, effective immediately." Oklahomans don't fool around. They like things done right now. Now, it's just the latest example of extreme politicians and their white Christian nationalist backers pushing through laws that tear down healthy boundaries between religion and government. Bills like this are designed to enforce the idea of the United States as a, quote, Christian nation. It's their idea of keeping their version of religion in the center of community life. It also tends to intimidate those who stand up for true religious freedom for all Americans, whatever their faith or non-faith or beliefs. Those putting these laws in place often say they are returning to the belief of our, quote, founding fathers. They say they are merely uplifting, quote, our Judeo-Christian values. But Jewish believers are not happy with this conflating of Jewish principles of faith with Christian Orthodox creeds, like the one that says you're saved only through Christ's sacrifice. And one can ask, whose Christian values will prevail? Catholic Christian? Lutheran Christian? Evangelical Christian? Latter-day Saints Christian or Southern Baptist Christian. Now, one of the founding fathers who are most opposed to establishing laws that conflict with a person's religious beliefs was the person who signed or who wrote the Declaration of Independence, that document we celebrated just 2 days ago, Thomas Jefferson. Along with Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, Jefferson authored the Declaration of Independence. But in spite of this achievement, it is difficult to fit the historical Jefferson into a neat and tidy portrait with what we have come to learn about his personal life. I'm thinking about these contradictions between his personal and public stance. For example, he was known to overlook the excesses of the French Revolution. He was the owner of more than 100 slaves, and he partnered with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings, and fathered several of her children. With these caveats, let us just make a modest claim that Jefferson can still be viewed by us today as having been a profound prophetic voice for what we could label as America's civil religion. In this original draft, in his original draft of the Declaration of Independence, we can read a more explicit link to civil religion when Jefferson wrote, quote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." In the revised version, those words were changed, but they're still powerfully persuasive. We all know them. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Well, life, liberty, and pursuing happiness was not really meant for the more than 2 million African slaves that were in America at that time, nor did it mean those who were indentured to serve out debts that they owed, nor did it apply to women at that time. They were not allowed to vote and have happiness in that realm. So from calling this a civil religion, the more public and political realm of his social life, I just want to explore Jefferson's more personal religious beliefs. When Jefferson was born, April 13, 1743, the Church of England was still the established church in colonial Virginia. Jefferson's early religious upbringing was relatively commonplace. He was baptized, he was married, and buried in the Anglican or today what we call the Episcopal Church. Anglican ministers provided his early education, and he was a common member of the gentry. He was elected as a young man to the vestry of his local congregation, which was both a civil and a religious post in those times. While attending the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Jefferson began to question traditional religious beliefs. He studied under a William Small, a Scottish Enlightenment professor, and the only member of the faculty who was not an Anglican minister. Jefferson developed an affinity for John Locke's thought and readings, and also the French iconoclast Voltaire and other Enlightenment thinkers who did not profess standard religious doctrines. Over time, Jefferson's religion became increasingly unconventional. He rejected many precepts important to Christian belief at that time, including the divinity of Jesus of Nazareth, the concept of the Trinities, in which God exists simultaneously and co-equally as the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. He denied the possibility of biblical miracles, including the claim that Mary conceived Jesus while remaining a virgin, and that Jesus was resurrected after death. He also rejected atonement, the idea that Christ's death allowed for the forgiveness of sin. The doctrine of original sin, which holds that all men and women are born sharing in the sin of Adam and Eve, was ridiculous to Jefferson. He believed that a rational, loving God would not punish one person for the sins of another. Jefferson was equally dismissive of Calvinism and predestination, that belief that all men and women are fated from birth to be saved or eternally damned. He also actively objected to the idea of salvation by faith, insisting that humans must be judged based on their deeds, not creeds, by their actions, not by what they believed or the words of their belief. Jefferson began to urge friends and relations to pursue their own rationalistic religion, the one that he espoused, telling his nephew that he, his nephew, should question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear. Now, Jefferson did maintain a firm belief in a benevolent creator, God. He was a deist, as it was termed back then. He is often somewhat thought of that word. Deists believe that God can be found through reason alone. With the rituals of organized religion, and the creator does not become one interested in the world. For his part, Jefferson believed in God's continuing intervention in the universe. Though having rejected biblical miracles, he seemed not to have believed in the efficacy of prayer to obtain miraculous intervention. Well, while there is doubt among some historians, he also apparently had some belief in an afterlife. He came to believe that if there was a future state of reward and punishment, it could serve as a useful social device in controlling social behavior. You tell someone, if you do that, you're going to be damned forever. They think about maybe their actions. So he felt that it had a practical effect. Now, among his contemporaries, Jefferson often shared his beliefs with thinkers like Benjamin Rush, a universalist living at that time. He's now known as the father of American psychiatry. And Jefferson would exchange letters with him discussing issues like mental health and religious belief. It was Benjamin Rush who helped found the first hospital for those who were mentally ill. Before that time, those who suffered from mental illness were considered criminal, and they were jailed along with other criminals. But it was during his concern for religion that it became a common topic in his private correspondence after he was elected president. He began to read and reread the works of one Joseph Priestley. Priestley wrote a book called An History of the Corruptions of Christianity. Jefferson became convinced by the turn of the 19th century that, as he wrote to Priestley, Jesus' morality was the most benevolent and sublime probably that has ever been taught. It was in this period that he began again to identify himself as a Christian, by which he meant being a devotee of Jesus' ethical teachings. Jefferson was particularly taken by the fact that while various religious sects disagreed violently on dogma, and such disagreements had played an important role in those bloody conflicts of the 16 and 1700s, where people were burned at the stake for their quote, false beliefs. He thought that there were some fundamental teachings that could be shared and were shared by many religions, like one that said, do unto others what you would want to do unto yourself, the so-called golden rule. Many religions have that same kind of teaching. In retirement, he wrote to John Adams, with whom he had many fallings out when he served as vice president to Adams and during the early part of his career as the third president. But they began to get along in their older years. And he said, these moral precepts innate in man made a part of his physical constitution, and they should guide the growth of a rational American religion free of the control of dogmatic ministers. His growing devotion to Jesus' ethics only served to increase his antipathy for what he viewed as the corruption of Jesus' moral teachings by what he called the priestcraft of the day. Those were the clergy of his day. For they, he believed, determined that religion and the support of government could be used to maintain their power and influence. It was particularly significant then that Jefferson saw Jesus' crucifixion as the result of an alliance between church and state, the effort of priests to maintain their positions of power. As a result of this newfound dedication to Jesus' philosophy, Jefferson spent many hours excerpting from the Bible what he believed were Jesus' true statements, ignoring those that he thought had been corrupted by subsequent reports or writers. As he writes, easily distinguishable as diamonds on a dunghill. These were the gems that he thought were worthy of Jesus' teachings. Initially, Jefferson compiled a small pamphlet of quotations that he entitled The Philosophy of Jesus. And then that little work was replaced by what he called The Life and Morals of Jesus. It's the Jefferson Bible. He titled it The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Gospels in Greek, Latin, French, and English. And if you open up any of the pages, there he placed a Greek translation, a Latin translation, a French translation, and an English translation. And he could read those languages. He read Greek and Latin and French and, of course, English. This was only shared with very few people. Two copies are only known to have been produced by him. He wanted to demystify the history of Jesus and his teaching, excluding miracles and ending with Jesus being placed in the tomb. Jefferson often read from his collection before retiring in the evening. This collection, the Jefferson Bible, was not published commercially until early in the 20th century, although its existence was known during Jefferson's time. According to one historian, Jefferson didn't intend the Bible to be read by others. He composed it only for himself. This is how he began to see his religion as something very, very personal. He cherished those diamonds that he found. Now, during his lifetime, that Jefferson Bible, which he willed to Martha Randolph, his eldest daughter, in the 1880s, a student at Johns Hopkins University, Cyrus Adler, found a cut-up book in a private library. And when he learned they were Jefferson's, he began a search for the book they had become. In 1895, Adler finally got access to the Jefferson Bible. By that time, the first volume, The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, was lost. But Jefferson's great-granddaughter agreed to sell that second volume, The Morals, The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, to the Smithsonian Institution. And that's how we today now have copies of that book. From 1904 to the 1950s, incoming senators received their own copy of this Bible. That practice ended once the government-sponsored printing ran out. But in the 1990s, economist Judd Patton revived that tradition and began mailing to each member of Congress a Jefferson Bible. In 2012, the American Humanist Association reissued the Jefferson Bible and sent copies to Barack Obama and members of Congress, Senate, and House. But they also include copies of the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, and other sacred writings as Bibles. Jefferson died on July 4th, 1826, the same day that his friend and Unitarian John Adams died. On his burial monument are these words: "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia." That was it. He was too modest to mention that he was also the third president of the United States. He failed to mention that he was the one who began and accomplished the purchase of the Louisiana Territory and many other positions and services. The rational Christianity of Thomas Jefferson may become more increasingly known, possibly, who knows, by reasonable persons in our 21st century, but we should not allow it to be distorted by conservative Christians who would want to lump up all the founding fathers into one born-again, Bible-believing group. We can help in this effort by being more informed, unafraid, keeping our eyes wide open to own Jefferson and to honor the principles of reason, tolerance, and conscience. Unitarian principles, universalist principles. He courageously worked to establish and uphold those in his life. So let me just close with, so may it be. There is a documentation that he did free the children, several of the children of Sally Hemings, rather than retain them as slaves. But he wouldn't do it for Sally, and he wouldn't do it for most or all of the rest of the slave community that he needed for his economic survival, because he had run up so many debts that even if he had sold off every one of the slaves, he still would not have enough money to pay all of his debts. So, I mean, he had these contradictions and these conflicts within his own life, which prevented him. Thaddeus Kosciuszko, the Polish major who designed the fort at West Point, offered to buy all of Jefferson's slaves, but Jefferson turned him down. I mean, that's how narrow his sense of economic strife was. That's my take on it. Our closing words are by Reverend Forrest Church. Forrest did edit a version of Jefferson's Bible, which can be found on our UU bookstore website. Jefferson's personal pursuit of painlessness led him to anesthetize his conscience, tragically so with respect to slavery, whenever it caused him discomfort. But on the 4th of July, he got America right. The Declaration of Independence elevated people's sights by placing human law on a higher moral pediment. The result was a civil ethic in which the ideals of liberty and equality received unprecedented priority. In his draft to the preamble, the truths that we know as inalienable, Jefferson described as sacred and undeniable. The transcendent point of reference was no longer the monarch, but the people themselves, whose rights he endowed with sovereign, even divine authority. Individuals thus became ends in themselves, not means by which to advance some other agent's ends. In his view, far from compromising faith, this emphasis on liberty perfected faith by ceding it full range. In its ringing, redemptive moral urgency, Jefferson's preamble is rightly remembered as the American Creed.